We'll start our last session here looking at treasure tales and at least one parable by Jesus that has some treasure themes and motifs with it as well, and see what we can do. By way of introduction again, I'm Michael Pellett. I teach at the University of Saskatchewan, and I am also a Lutheran pastor at a congregation in Saskatoon. And that's enough about me. The rest is all quite boring. As we look at treasure tales, again, our review for the week, and again, for those of you who it's your first time here, what we've done is I started out with a little poem by Emily Dickinson, who again kind of calls into question the whole notions and understandings of treasure. Is there really such a thing as treasure? Is it as worthwhile as we think it is? Or is indeed the whole sense of treasure and pursuit of it actually a sham and showing those who pursue it to be a sham? That's an open question. You can think about that as much as you would like. As we look at treasure tales and try to interpret and understand them, I think there are three things we need to look at. The plot and what happens in that story. Who are the actors in it? What do they do or what happens to them? And of course, the other items that are in the story. Whether they come across other animals, other obstacles, is it a field? We've talked about treasure tales of people, a day laborer plowing in a field and so on and so forth. Just paying attention to that. As well with these key understandings of a plot, what I've tried to do each day is pick treasure tales that emphasize one of these key elements in the plot. So we've looked at hiding, seeking, finding, obtaining, and today is securing. And so perhaps this is your lucky day, because if you secure the treasure, it's yours. But then the whole question is whether or not you're going to secure it. So, and some plots have a notion of using, and that may or may not be there. We won't talk about that as much again today. We'll look at securing. Also, what goes on in the plot here in all of these things is different kinds of tensions and things that take place. So that between hiding and seeking, seeking, finding, obtaining, all of that, there can be a contest, there can be a competition, there can be a struggle, right? Sometimes to get to the treasure, you're going to have to fight beasts and dragons and other people or gods or who knows what. Contest, competition. Often, as we found out, the whole sense of seeking, finding, obtaining, and today again we'll see securing a treasure will involve luck or accident or chance, like winning the lottery, right? No one has a great surefire method for winning the lottery. It's luck that your number may come up. Or again, if we want to bring in the realm of the gods, or theologically for us, the realm of God, we might want to think about providence or fate or destiny, that the gods are with us and help us to see, find, seek, obtain treasures. Often with it, there are certain superstitions and taboos which you need to follow or overcome in order to find those treasures. And often there's a notion of paradox, that you see those that one engages in seeking without finding, right? It's never guaranteed you will be able to find, obtain, or secure the treasure. Or there is finding without seeking. And again, particularly, and those of you who have been here before know that as we looked at treasure parables, as Jesus tells them, there's always paradox at work. It's never what you think it is. Because after all, if that be the case, then the parables would have been easily understood. And the Gospels tell us that no one understood Jesus' parables. And the disciples would come to him afterwards and ask, "What did this stuff mean? Will you tell us?" And often then an explanation is provided. So again, as we'll look at one, maybe two parables of Jesus today, we'll see that sense of paradox. And so we're going to look at some securing treasure stories. And the first one, I'm not going to read through it because it would be way too long, is the English poet Chaucer, right? Everyone who's taken English literature somewhere along the line has had to endure or enjoy Chaucer, right? Whichever side you're on that one. And one of the tales, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, one of the tales that he tells is the Pardoner's Tale. And the Pardoner's Tale indeed is a story about these two folks who were going off and looking for treasure, and indeed they had found it. But then what happens is each of these characters wants the treasure for himself and wants to murder the other one. And so the one decides to murder the other by poisoning his food. The other is far more upfront and crass and simply murders, right? Kills his friend. And so what happens, ironically, the person who kills his friend kills him and then says, "Oh, look, the table is set with a great meal. Well, I guess before I get the treasure, I'll sit down and have a little lunch." So, of course, he eats the poison meal and dies. So there you go. Right? That again, what can prevent you from securing your treasure is either, as Chaucer would say, your own stupidity or your own cupidity, your own greed, right? So that again, often there's one way in which we won't find the treasure. Another treasure story. This time I'll just read a short excerpt. It's from Iceland, the Völsunga Saga, and its understanding here, the key word that comes out of this is the notion of bane, and gives, I would suggest, a whole new meaning to the notion of banal or banality. And just listen to this, and then you can tell me what it means. And again, I've summarized the plot, and then I'll tell you where I quote a few places. It says, as we go into this saga, the dwarf Andvari is robbed of his treasure, and, quote, "he cried out that gold ring, yea, and all the gold withal, should be the bane of every man who should own it thereafter," unquote. It is acquired by Hreidmar, who is thereafter slain by his dragon son, Fafnir. It is the turn of the hero, now Sigurd, who kills Fafnir, thereby fulfilling the warning made to Hreidmar and Fafnir when they first acquired this gold. And again, the saga reads this way, quote, "Thou and thy son art not fated to thrive. The bane shall it be of you both," unquote. Before Fafnir is killed by Sigurd, Fafnir warns Sigurd in his turn, quote, The same gold which I have owned shall be thy bane too, and the bane of every one soever who own it. Unquote. And so eventually Sigurd will be killed by Guttorm, by which time one begins to ponder a whole new understanding of banal. So, what does this treasure story and securing tell you?
Give up.
Give up. What about treasures?
It can be a curse.
It can be a curse. Treasures are cursed. And why are treasures cursed?
Well, because they're associated with greed.
They're associated with greed. And that as soon as you combine that human desire, that human characteristic of greed with whatever you have out there, the result will always be negative. It will always be a curse upon you, upon your family, upon anyone who happens or tries to secure or possess the treasure. There you go. So let's all hope you don't have any treasures. Here's a short little story from Korea. A king had received a bowl which could never be emptied, or whatever was placed, emptied of whatever was placed within it, and also a golden ruler by whose measurements the dead could be revived. When the king awoke the next morning, he thought it over and concluded that if he kept the treasures too long, there would eventually be too many people in the world and they would all become very lazy. He decided to return the treasures. The moral of the story is... Well, what were the two treasures he had?
Eternal life, a bowl, and a ruler.
Right, he had a bowl and a ruler. And what would the bowl do?
Create excess.
It would create excess. So you always had, we'll just say, excess abundance. And the ruler would give you
expansion,
and it would make everyone alive, if you will. It would give you eternal life. And so, you would say, well, now what's the matter with this guy? Here he had something that would give him everything he always wanted, and he could live forever. And you give it back. Why would you do that?
Too much of a good thing.
Can you ever really have too much of a good thing?
No.
Can there ever be too much cod almond bean? Too much Holden ice cream? Yeah, maybe.
Well, I can see where people would become lazy if they were given everything they wanted. But why didn't the guy just keep it for himself? Mm-hmm. He must not have been so selfish.
Well, perhaps, or again, he doesn't even keep it for himself because he doesn't think that these two things are all they're cracked up to be. Right? I mean, the opposite side of this is he gives this back. He doesn't want eternal life, right? The alternative there would be somehow saying, death is all right at times. And here, instead of excess abundance, the opposite would be some notion of lack or need. And somehow he's saying, at times to lack things, at times to have needs, is okay.
Well, and that he's the king, right?
Yeah, he's the king.
He's also giving, he's also taking that away from, as a good leader, taking it away from his people as well. So presumably he's doing something for the larger community, not just himself. Right?
Yes. So you said he was a good leader, but is that a good leader to take away excess abundance of life from your people? It is. Don't you think Obama would have even gotten elected by more if he could have promised those two things?
I think the recession is teaching us this.
Is teaching you what?
The excess abundance is disappearing.
Yeah, but now don't people want, aren't they all looking for that golden bowl that will never empty?
Can I go back to it?
A chicken in every pot? Isn't that what FDR promised in the 1932
Just
election?
Just not 10 chickens in every pot.
Just not 10 chickens, okay.
You need some angst for growth.
You need angst for growth. Wow.
Isn't there some sort of peace, though, in giving everything up? Abundance, especially the, he probably felt that he didn't need that all, that he'd be more peaceful, humble.
Yeah. There's something there, right? I mean, again, obviously what we at first blush would think to be ultimate value, certainly treasures, he's thinking this through and says, no, I really don't think those truly are treasures.
Well, they're contrary to nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yet, our human nature is such that we do want this often, don't we? Yes, please.
If we have eternal life, would we appreciate it? If we had everything that we wanted, would we appreciate it? It's only because it comes to an end at some point that you appreciate your life. It's only because you still have things to gain that you appreciate what you have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's part of it too, isn't it? Often what we truly treasure is what we don't have, or something like that. Yes, please.
And doesn't it also say that there are other things which are bigger or greater treasures, like relationships? You can't buy them.
Could be that. That's certainly implied, because obviously excess abundance and eternal life in and of themselves wouldn't give you a relationship. That's right.
Well, and also there's a way in which he's not really necessarily commenting on what's
Excuse
in
me.
The bowl.
Looking for a 12-step meeting?
The 12-step meeting, I believe, is upstairs. Is it upstairs?
Upstairs.
They said upstairs.
Upstairs in Koinonia or in the village center?
It's not over there.
It's
they said,
it
was over there. They said come over here.
Okay.
She's checking schedule.
I'll look up here.
Okay. I think if you go in through, it's upstairs.
It's in the upper room.
If you go in through the middle door here and upstairs.
Sorry, I need to interrupt you.
That's fine. Yes, you were saying.
I think that some of it is hooked to how we get those things, too. One thing to have abundance in a bowl, and another thing to have abundance that we live for and make of our hands. And I think you mentioned that he said people would be lazy.
Yes.
So I think somehow it's in the process of how we achieve what it is that we want as well. That's an issue.
Okay, so we treasure it more if we work for it. Okay.
Yeah, I just read a book by Jose Saramago in which there was a country where one morning everyone stopped dying, and one of the first objections came from the church, because the church said, if people aren't dying, where's the need for religion? If there's no end to life, where's the need for religion? It might be a tangent, but it might fail.
It's certainly part of what to think about.
One struck that he seems to be a good leader, that he wasn't just thinking about himself, but that he was obviously watching his people living on a daily basis in relationship and the things going on, and he could tell that the way that they were living wasn't what he wanted for them and what they, you know, might want. But they couldn't see that, and so he had to make the decision for them.
We'll contrast this leader in Korea from a little story that comes from the Jerusalem Talmud. A story, it's called the Alexander Legend, and this is supposedly an incident that happens with Alexander the Great. And again, Alexander dies in 333 before the Common Era. So just roughly speaking to say this is supposedly a story happens 300 years before the birth of Christ. And it reads, Alexander of Macedon visited King Keziah. The latter showed him much gold and silver. Alexander said to him, I do not need your gold and silver. I came only because I wished to see your method, how you act, and how you dispense justice. While he was arguing with him, a man came with a complaint against his neighbor who had sold him an unplowed field, and in digging it, the buyer happened to find a treasure of dinars in a dunghill. And if you've borne with me before, for others, you know, plowing in fields, finding treasures, and they're always in dunghill. It seems to pop up all the time. Right? So if any of you are looking for treasure, I would suggest that the drainage field out there is the first place to look. That's your best bet, according to all these treasure stories. But please wear your rubber boots. All right, so he's out here again, right? They plowing in the field, discovers the treasure. The buyer argued, I bought the field and the dunghill in it, but I did not buy the treasure. The seller maintained, I sold the field and the dunghill and all it contained. While both were discussing the problem, the king said to one of them, Have you a son? Yes, he replied. Then he asked the other, Have you a daughter? Yes, he said. Said the king to both, Then marry them and let the treasure belong to both. Alexander laughed at the king's decision, and the king asked him, Why are you laughing? Have I not judged well? Had this happened among you in your empire, how would you have judged? Alexander replied, We should have killed both, and the treasure would have gone to the king. There you go. Any comments on that one?
Rather well.
Yes, please.
Did I understand that right? The guy who sold the field was claiming that it's not his anymore.
That's right.
So that's for me the more interesting point.
Yeah.
That they said, well, I've sold it, it's not mine anymore. Usually you would get the story, well, it's been mine, and whatever you find there, it sure belongs still to me. Okay.
But what we have going on here, and this is part of the historical context to supply, and those of you who were here yesterday might remember this, that there are all sorts of Jewish laws about to whom the treasure belongs. And it's the kind of thing that if you sold the field, didn't know the treasure was there, but it's not ancient and very old treasure, but that might have been there because of your family owning the land, The new person who plows and discovers that treasure is to give it back to the original owner, just like we have here. But then here, this original owner apparently feels this must be ancient treasure. It never was in our family as long as we've owned the land. So since it's ancient treasure, it's the new guy who bought it. And so what you have here is an example of two pious Jews. And why, right, the one says, following the law, oh no, no, it's not mine, please, you take it. And the other one says, oh no, no, it's not mine, please, you take it. Right? And so they're both pious to make sure that the other person is not cheated. And so the king now, as you can see there, is kind of trying to act with Solomonic wisdom to say, all right, you've got a son, you've got a daughter, you folks marry, then on both sides now, the treasure is in the family, and therefore, you get to keep it. And they all live happily ever after.
Right? Well, actually, what would happen today, if they found dinosaur bones on my property, it would belong to the people and the government.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have this problem.
Right, it's a different context. Although, the way this story ends here, Alexander's kind of in that notion, right? What do you think of the ending? Alexander's response to this, right? We should have killed both, and the treasure would have gone to the king.
That grammar, I presume, means we would have, right? We would have done this, right? So he was, I would think he would be very impressed. And simply making commentary on the corruption of his own government.
Okay. So you think his response shows how impressed he was?
Yes.
No?
That's my guess.
Do others read it differently? Why did he laugh?
Alexander was as a god, wasn't he?
He thought so.
In his reign?
He thought so, yeah.
Yeah. I think he thought the other guy was stupid for not taking it for himself.
Yeah.
With his mentality.
I think so.
But why would you be searching another place to find out how other people do things?
Yeah.
If there wasn't something about him that was seeking something good.
Well, that's a problem between wisdom and money matters.
So again, right, it brings all that up, right? What is your treasure? Is your treasure wisdom? Or is your treasure $5 million in the bank? Which would you prefer? The $5 million? Or would you like to be wise? Should you vote? Yeah, I mean, the whole story again, there's some paradox there, because the way it starts out, right, Alexander visits this king, and this king, namely, right again, showed him much gold and silver. And Alexander says to him, you know, put that stuff, I don't want your gold and silver, I want to see your method, your wisdom about how you act justly. So, okay, we get an example of that, and then he laughs and said, well, you know, my kingdom, we would have killed both those guys and I'd get the treasure. So you go, well, you didn't want the silver and gold, and yet you're saying,
you still want,
I would have taken the treasure. So now again, it's the king, is that a criticism of his way of doing it, and he's really admiring this sense of justice, your interpretation, or is it a more cynical interpretation, finally, that says, you know, wisdom schmizdom, give me the money, right? Show me the money. I think it leaves it open-ended. Although it certainly shows us from this Jewish perspective, the two landowners in the story acting piously, if you will, the moral of the story for all of us is that's the way we should act too, right?
Right, and it's not just the two, it's the people and the government are all acting justly. I mean,
Yes, do we see an Alexander who wanted to learn but not really? It's like somebody going into a bookstore and saying, could you sell me a book that will change my mind? But I do want to read a book.
Yeah. Or again, right, do we all say we treasure wisdom, but not that much. We treasure justice, but not that much. One more story here. This is, again, this is a Greek story told by Philostratus, and it's the adventures of Apollonius of Tyana, who again is seen as this wise sage about 400 years before Christ, wandering around all over the place, and Philostratus records some of these legends and tales. And again, this is Apollonius is traveling in India. And he meets one of the kings in India, right, a ruler of certain lands in India, who again asks for Apollonius's advice on a lawsuit that he has to judge. And this is where we pick it up. The king from this India region speaks. I admit, said the king, that I am perplexed, and that is why I want your advice. For one man has sold to another land, in which there lay a treasure as yet undiscovered. And sometime afterwards, the land, being broken up, revealed a certain chest, which the person who sold the land says belongs to him, rather than to the other, for that he would never have sold the land if he had known beforehand that he had a fortune thereon. But the purchaser claims that he acquired everything that he found in the land, which henceforth was his. And both these contentions are just. And I shall seem ridiculous if I order them to share the gold between them. For any old woman could settle the matter in that way. This is not an enlightened society. Patriarchy lives here in this parable, right? Apollonius responds, it seems to me, O king, right to weigh these men in the balance, as it were, and to examine their respective lives. For I cannot believe that the gods would deprive the one even of his land unless he had been a bad man, or that they would, on the other hand, bestow on the other even what was under the land, unless he had been better than the man who sold it. The two claimants came back the next day, and the seller was convicted of being a ruffian who had neglected the sacrifices to the gods on that land. But the other was found to be a decent man and a most devout worshiper of the gods. Accordingly, the opinion of Apollonius prevailed, and the better of the two men quitted the court as one on whom the gods had bestowed the boon. So.
They weren't two pious Jews, were they?
They weren't two pious Jews. Or at least one of them wasn't. So what do you think of that story?
If it's number three up there.
it fits number three.
Yeah.
Whole sense of providence. Apollonius makes his judgments about somehow, right, the reason the person who bought the land gets the treasure and the one who sold the land never found it is because of their piety, and the providence of the gods makes sure that, if you will, justice prevails. Right. That's the sense of wisdom, to just simply say to both, divide the treasure, right? Any old woman could have done that. Right? But certainly a sense there of there's no wisdom in that. Because somehow getting treasure, having treasure, involves more than finding it, involves more than just security. But there's, again, a whole sense of piety and favor of the gods, so that if you do not have the favor of the gods, you will never be able to secure or keep your treasure. Right. Plato, in his dialogue, The Laws, says the same thing. And let me just read that. He says here, "As the first of such things, let us mention treasure, that which a man has laid by in some store for himself and his family, he not being one of my parents." So he defines treasure that way. "I must never pray to the gods to find, nor, if I do find it, may I move it, nor may I ever tell of it to the so-called soothsayers, who are certain to counsel me to take up what is laid down in the ground. A treasure which neither he himself nor any of his forefathers has deposited breaks a law most fair. What penalty should such a man suffer? God knows what. At the hands of the gods one shall suffer it." So Plato's whole notion here is you don't find treasures, or if you do, you leave it alone, because treasure is the realm of the gods. And if you mess with it, it's going to be nothing but trouble. So in that sense, what do you do if you find and obtain a treasure? Get rid of it as fast as you can. It will not finally be for your own well-being. All right. Is that really so? Let's look at a parable of Jesus. Again, about a sense of treasure. And this will be a parable in Matthew chapter 13, verses 45 and 46. The parable of the pearl. By the way, anyone here named Margaret?
My middle name, no.
Okay. Margaret is the Greek word that means pearl. Just in case. So any Margarets, Maggies, Peggies, whatever in the room, know that you are pearls. Okay. Again, a nice little two-sentence parable. It reads something like this. "Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking fine pearls, and finding one very valuable pearl, went away, sold everything he had, and bought it." All right. The moral of the story is, those who've been here before are laughing because they know this is going to be a setup, right? The moral of the story is,
well, nothing we have is worth as much as salvation.
Right. Right. That obviously here the notion, the pearl is the sense of salvation, the pearl is the sense of the gospel, and you give up everything for the gospel. Right. That's the way that this parable has usually been interpreted.
Usually.
It's just like that.
By a
all
lot
right.
of people.
Huh?
By a lot of people.
By a lot of people, you betcha. But there's, again, a problem with this. And again, those of you who were here yesterday about the treasure in the field have got a little advantage here as you think this through. What's the problem that this poor merchant has?
The laws?
No, he's okay. He hasn't broken any laws. Like that was the problem yesterday. The person yesterday was a real shyster. Right? He did things that were illegal and wanted to defraud somebody. But this is a merchant, and he's looking through his merchant. He discovers this, and he makes a transaction. Good business person, all of that. So in that sense, he's legal.
But if he's a merchant, isn't his job to sell things? So now instead of having a bunch of things, he has only one thing.
Right. And... Right? I mean, and he's broke. Precisely. Well, it tells us he sold everything he had. Right? So he sold everything. He's got the pearl.
And he can't sell it.
Well, if he sells it, then doesn't that go against what you just thought the story told you? Sell everything.
Okay.
So you know, everything, the gospel, salvation has every, all important, but if you've got the pearl and you don't sell it, what have you got? Nothing. You're broke. You're penniless. Poverty. Right? Just like yesterday on the one hand, this is a rash, stupid person. So that's the point of the parable. Jesus is saying, the kingdom of heaven is like being really stupid. That may not go over, I don't know, maybe in your congregation, but probably in my congregation if I'd say, folks, Jesus tells us, be really stupid. They probably wouldn't like that a lot, all right? Or they would certainly say, well, come on, how can being really stupid and the gospel, God's reign and rule, God's graciousness, how will that fit together? But it can't just be the thing sell all for the sake of the gospel, because you see, in that sense, you kind of end up with nothing, too. So, you know, this is our problem with our Jesus again, this paradox stuff. So what do you think he's trying to get at?
Well, he gave everything for us.
Yeah. But would that be the same kind of giving and acting as this merchant? Do you want to say Jesus is like the merchant? Gave up everything and then ended up broke?
No, but it's been said the foolishness of God is that.
Yeah. Well, what is the foolishness of God here? I think you're right about there. There's some kind of foolishness going on in the parable, which we usually don't catch.
Well, if I look at pearl, it's more the beauty of it than the value itself.
Okay. And therefore...
You have different value systems.
Okay.
I don't have to pay for that pearl, but it might mean something much more to my heart.
And so maybe he becomes no longer a merchant,
yeah.
A buyer and seller of things.
But what's he going to do with the pearl?
How's
he going to live?
Look at his
skin.
Oh, he can just look at it?
Well, he can still.
There's an entrepreneur.
Sell tickets.
Come see the pearl of great price. $5. Yeah, what do you think?
We're afraid to think.
Well, is it somehow about selflessness? I'm not sure how, but you know, if we give up everything, or if we concentrate more on the greater good than our own personal good, which sort of seems to me like, you know, be less concerned with what we have. If he sees the pearl as the greater good, you know, is it sort of a heaven on earth parable?
Perhaps. Maybe one way of thinking about it is saying that, is Jesus perhaps, instead of telling us something that we should do, wanting us to think about something we shouldn't do? Right? Is he saying perhaps, like, don't be like this merchant? Because this merchant, you see, ends up broke.
Yes.
The kingdom of God can't be purchased. It can only be given to us. And we can't hold on to it either.
Yeah. I think what Jesus is pushing us here in this, when it comes to this sense of securing, is to say, to understand the gospel as grace, to understand how Jesus has given up everything and all for us. Yes, indeed we have it, and it is a pearl, but can we possess it? Is it ever such that we are, in this notion here, able to secure it? In the sense of thinking that it's my possession, right? You know, my gospel, you can't have it. Or is it because if you think about it that way, then aren't you really spiritually bankrupt? Because again, is not the gospel something that is dynamic? Isn't salvation something that is dynamic, right? Forgiving one another, loving the neighbor, loving the enemy. And that's something, again, whether that's forgiveness or love or however it is that you want to express the dynamics and the work of the gospel in your life, it's not a possession. It's not like a coin collection that you can put on your shelf or put in a safety deposit box and every now and then bring out for display or charge people to come in and look at it. Right? The gospel's something different. So maybe Jesus is pushing us to think about, don't be like the merchant. Don't think the gospel, don't think the kingdom of heaven is like something that you can possess. But recognize its liveliness, its dynamics, how it's always working in your life and in the lives of others. And that's the treasure that's there. That's the pearl, right? Again, if you will, at that point, and we still use this expression, it then becomes a pearl of wisdom. Right? As you were saying, pearl can mean something other, can have a different value than simply monetary value or material value. This might be the pearl of wisdom, to know the gospel can't be possessed, but it's always dynamic and alive.
Can you explain then why the order of the parables? Why the first one was treasure hidden in a field? Why would that be first and then the pearl would be second?
Well, I think here again, Matthew is working. There's actually the next one about the net. It kind of works with three parables here. But I think at least with the treasure in the field and with this merchant and the pearl, remember with the treasure in the field too, we ended up saying how the usual way we interpret that again too is this guy's finding the treasure, rehides it, sells everything, buys the field. And we say again, oh yes, you give up everything for the sake of the gospel. But then we looked at it and said, well, why did this person rehide it? Well, because he had to buy the field. And as we know, as we had looked at that Jewish law, again, he wasn't a pious Jew, right? He acted illegally and also stupidly because, again, selling everything he has, having bought the field illegally, if he shows this treasure, everybody's going to know he found treasure and it has to revert back to the original owner. So again, the guy in the field had a treasure and he couldn't do anything with it. And so he was bankrupt and penniless. Mm-hmm. This merchant has a treasure but acts rashly in thinking, oh boy, now I've got a treasure, I can possess it. But, right, merchants never want to keep anything. They want to sell it because that's the only way you make money. You got to sell it again. And so he's in that sense, acts rashly, acts stupidly by thinking, oh, now that I've possessed it, now that I've secured it and it's mine, I can live happily ever after. And the thing is, no, you're penniless, broke, can't do a thing. So don't think just because you have the gospel, oh great, now it's mine, I live happily ever after. No, because the gospel doesn't work that way. It's gracious, it's dynamic. You don't possess it.
You don't have love unless you give it away.
That's right. Yes, please.
I'm not sure I've got this all gelled in my head, but he says the kingdom of heaven is like. And I'm wondering, thinking, if maybe the merchant is not really God, but talking about God's extravagant, spontaneous, a little bit like the parable of the prodigal son, how the father is just overwhelming in the welcome. And if the kingdom of heaven is like that, the father can't stop from bestowing the great treasure on us. I don't know where that goes, but...
Okay. Yeah, I mean that. I think you're kind of halfway into something, and now where do you want us to end up with that,
yeah,
right? Where to take it? An alternate. This is again from the Gospel of Thomas. As I said, right, one of the documents that did not make it into our canonical Bible. But again, has a parable of the merchant, but note, it goes in a different direction. Jesus said, the kingdom of the Father is like a merchant who had a consignment of merchandise and who discovered a pearl. That merchant was shrewd. He sold the merchandise and bought the pearl alone for himself. You too seek this unfailing and enduring treasure where no moth comes near to devour and no worm destroys. But then in the Gospel of Thomas, there's another parable similar to this. And then it ends, kind of the conclusion to these parables. Jesus says, let him who seeks continue seeking until he finds. When he finds, he will become troubled. Troubled.
That's why I didn't make it.
No. We all became troubled and said, that's out of here. Yeah, so what do you make of this parable, right? Similar to what we have in Matthew. I'm sure you can see all the connections there. A little different as well, right? It's going to make a different point. But this kind of, if you will, Jesus interpreting, explaining what he thinks it means here, and, you know, continue seeking till you find. But then when it comes to the whole securing question, it says, when he finds, he will become troubled. So why is finding, why is trying to secure the treasure going to make you troubled? And there again, I think we've got a bit of a link between the two, or thinking about it. If the gospel is the treasure, why would that be troubling? You know, again, aren't we supposed to think gospel, good, joy, I'm happy? Maybe kind of like that Korean king to say, wow, you know, I've got excess abundance in eternal life. Who could ask for more? Why would I be troubled?
Well, it's a free gift. We can't go out and get it.
Yeah. But why would that trouble you?
Well, is Thomas trying to say that as soon as we think we firmly understand it, then we're troubled? Then we've missed the mark?
That's probably part of it.
Or that we did something to secure it. It's a free gift of grace.
But is possession a part of that too, though?
Yeah, securing and possession are very close together. So again, why would notions of securing or possessing cause one to be troubled?
Because if we possess too much, we're holding on to it and not sharing it and letting go. We're possessing it. And that can be dangerous.
Why would that be dangerous?
Because we're not sharing it. The more we hold on to it, maybe the more closed-minded we become.
Okay.
And also, and I just faded out a little bit because I'm so tired, so I might have missed something that you said, but like my mom always says that some people are so often thinking about life in heaven instead of life on earth, and so maybe it's more about the journey instead of the treasure at the end of the journey, that it should be about the relationships and the way that you're living and the decisions that you're making and how you're worshiping and how you're studying and instead of what the treasure is at the end, that you're going to get that regardless, but focus on how you're getting there instead of where you're going or what the end goal is.
Okay, so there it's the sense, the kingdom of heaven, the gospel, God's grace. What we really need to think about is important for us right now in our lives now. You know, heaven, God's already handled that, taken care of that. Don't think about that as something you're going to earn, possess, get it. Let God worry about that and recognize the gospel at work right now. That's what you're saying there, Pastor?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyone else? Pearls of wisdom here.
You know, I just wonder, if I follow through the text, then Jesus asked, have you understood all this? And they answered, yes. And a lot of other things they didn't understand. So is it really that difficult? Or do we put in more into it? I like the idea of looking for that one important thing, which is a treasure just as a pearl, beauty, valuable, whatever it is, and not caring for my money or what it would cost me to to get that. So at the moment, I'm a bit confused.
Okay. I think that the latter portion there, when Jesus says, "Do you understand this?" and they all say yes, that's irony, because as we go on in the rest of Matthew's gospel, and it happens in Mark and Luke as well, we see, no, the disciples don't understand. And John even makes it more explicit for us when he always adds every now and then. We think it's a little throwaway phrase, but it's very important. And they didn't understand until after he was raised. So in other words, these parables here were confusing to the disciples. They thought they understood. Maybe again because they caught a surface meaning, which really wasn't there, or was, you know, didn't catch what's going on here in terms of the paradox. And there again, talking about it, even kind of paradoxically, that sense of value, right? I mean, as you look at a notion of a pearl, to say, okay, I value it for its beauty, not its monetary value. Okay, that's already thinking very differently than most folks will think about treasures. Right? And again, to say, and that certainly holds too, what happens if we understand the gospel not in, right, materialist terms, monetary terms, but what are those other values there? And indeed, are any of those gospel values, values that we could truly possess, or are they really values that we give away, use, work with? We can never say, I have it, I got it. Yes, please.
Is the word troubled? There could be a couple of interpretations of that. One would be, I'm concerned, or it could be actually troubled. I've encountered trouble. You know how that word is interpreted?
I think the way it's interpreted and the Greek word that's there could also be a notion of anxiety. So it's the sense here that, you know, when you find it, you will be anxious. Right? There's, you know, like, oh, now what?
Well, now what? I know this, but I want everyone to know this. I want the opportunity to give this away and to tell others. That's
mm-hmm.
troubling.
That's one aspect of troubling, to be sure. Yeah. Yes, please.
I don't know if this is a valid aspect of trouble here. But if gospel, the pearl, is the redemptive act of Christ, the suffering and the death of Christ, it would trouble us because we necessitated the suffering, our sins. That's trouble.
Okay, so that's pushing that parable really hard.
Well, it seems as though a lot of what Jesus preached turn our understanding of things upside down, and that turning of things upside down is a very anxiety producing kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I think he's saying when you finally encounter it, it's not going to be a happy thing. It will instead be something that's going to make you think and turn your perceptions upside down.
If we look at what the Kingdom of Heaven parables do all around, all in this text, it seems to me that what happens to the merchant, if the merchant is the Kingdom of Heaven, the Kingdom of Heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls. I get the impression that you could say that he's now broke, and you could say that he, that's a pretty crazy thing to do, were he indeed to continue to be a merchant. But I think I'm getting the impression that what this is sort of a transformative act, and that he really isn't a merchant anymore for any good reason that fits in his text, and that in and of itself is a kind of trouble, that kind of change, you know, a kind of radical change in who you are or what you thought, the road you thought you were going down, and all of a sudden everything is upside down, backwards, and you're no longer who it is that you thought you were.
Anyone else? We're kind of coming to the end of our time here. So any other comments?
It's one thing to worship the gospel, another to follow the gospel. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we're supposed to be broke when we receive the gift in terms of worldly stuff. Jesus was sure broke.
So that means it's all right to say, I can send you all out now with nothing. And you'll be happy, right? Well, thank you for your comments and your contributions. And again, working through particularly some of these parables to see just how rich they are in getting us to think about all sorts of other dimensions and facets of our treasured gospel. And what's there? So thank you very much. It was
thank you.
Enjoyable to be with you.